Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, February 28, 2018, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federal Society's Practice Group teleforum conference call, as today we discuss the oral argument in this morning's Supreme Court Minnesota Voters Alliance versus Mansky case. I'm Dean Reuter, General Counsel, Vice President, and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Very pleased to welcome a return guest to Teleforum today. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of that guest for today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future and will likely be transcribed. We welcome back Mr. Stephen Klein. He's an attorney at the Pillar of Law Institute, and perhaps most importantly, he attended oral argument this morning so we could all gain his insights into what transpired. With that, Stephen Klein, the floor is yours.
Thanks a lot, Dean. Well, it was a pretty exciting morning at the Supreme Court. This case, Minnesota Voters Alliance versus Mansky, is sought to answer the question of whether a provision of Minnesota law is unconstitutionally overbroad under the First Amendment. And it's a fairly long statute, but the Voters Alliance is only challenging one sentence of it, which prohibits a political badge, political button, or other political insignia from being worn at or about the polling place on primary or election day. What's looming in the background of this case is a case from the 1990s, Burson versus Freeman, which certainly came up a lot during arguments today. The ruling upheld a 100-foot buffer zone around polling places against electioneering. Though that did not address the polling place itself, as this case does, it's generally been assumed in lower courts and in the Eighth Circuit in this case that if the buffer zone is legitimate, surely, for whatever reason, a ban inside the polling place must be legitimate as well. Of course, electioneering, the idea you generally understood to be efforts to get people to vote for or against candidates or for or against something that's actually on the ballot, is a more narrowly defined term than just the term political. And so this ban has gone far beyond that. There's some tension whether the number of states that have similar bans, broad bans like Minnesota's, whether it's 9 states or 11 states. We heard two different answers this morning from the parties. But nevertheless, is certainly a very, very broad, but the question is whether it's unconstitutionally overbroad. Certainly want to give credit to the Pacific Legal Foundation for joining this case and at the cert stage and successfully getting cert and I think briefing it quite well on behalf of the Minnesota Voters Alliance, and certainly up against a number of attorneys on behalf of various respondents. So going into it was certainly a very active panel. Everybody with Thomas, Justice Thomas is the typical exception, but otherwise having a lot of participation from the justices and pretty hitting both sides really, really hard. And it's interesting because when you start to think of what does political mean, well, at first, you know, going and I think throughout the history of this case, it's basically leading to bans of not just attire that might say vote for or vote against Hillary Clinton, for example, or I'm with her, or some slogan unequivocally tied to a campaign, maybe even Make America Great Again. And then we start to move into something like a political organization, so wearing NRA attire, or if you're or MoveOn.org, or things of that nature. And a lot of those examples came up that, well, at what point and what is the actual limiting principle here? You know, interestingly, even under the current doctrine of electioneering, something like Make America Great Again, which is still being thrown around even now, well outside of Donald Trump's election, whether that really ties into an electioneering style provision. So it's when it came to the justices, many of them, particularly Justice Kennedy and Justice Alito and Roberts, are really seeking an articulation of that limiting principle. And it seemed that David Bremer, arguing for MVA, was much more on the side of hitting, well, listen, under unconstitutional overbreath, what this law simply does is go too far. And he seemed to go back to that and really fixate that on that, rather than going back and saying it's you know, the job of the Voters Alliance to start drawing a limiting principle, particularly in light of the facial challenge. The idea, and this came up in a little bit of briefing, and this is there was some arguments in the briefing, this idea that, well, we're talking about a tire here, so that we want to view this as a passive speech, which can also be a potential limiting principle. The idea that you're just wearing something doesn't really go into the area of electioneering, where, as in the case in Burson versus Freeman, where you have somebody actually in that buffer zone making an active effort to engage people who are trying to go vote. Justice Gorsuch shut that down pretty hard and pretty early on, so we didn't hear much of that raised after that, but basically saying that that was a bad idea and compared it to some criminal laws where the similar kind of distinctions haven't gone over very well. I want to add, it was interesting to me that a piece of this case that got dropped off somewhere along the way, and by the way, another credit to all counsel involved in this case, because it does originate from 2010, so we're going on its eighth birthday here before it finally got to the United States Supreme Court. So that's obviously a marathon of an effort, and much credit to everybody involved. But a piece of this case that was dropped off somewhere along the way was the part of the facial challenge, and the respondents really hit it hard in their briefing. And this was the concept that I'm not necessarily sure if it was the Voters Alliance, but one of the plaintiffs had an effort where they were wearing buttons that said, "Please ID me." So this idea, of course, and the idea of supporting voter ID efforts. Along with these buttons, some also displayed their ID while checking in at a polling place, and this was part of a subtle effort to convince voters around them, other people who were in line, that it was required to display ID under the law, when under Minnesota law that is not actually the case. So the facts certainly appear heated, certainly appear tied to the voter ID debate. Regretfully, I'm not intimately familiar with everything that happened in that case, but Mr. Bremer, again arguing for MVA, pretty unequivocally dismissed the button itself as something that he basically accepted that just the button itself could be banned by not necessarily the provision at issue, but by anti-deception or anti-fraud provisions that are also elsewhere in Minnesota law. That kind of surprised me that even the button, just that button itself, just "Please ID me," can be sort of prophylactically banned even under other laws. So and that also led to an interesting question, a question that I wish had been brought up today but was not. I'm genuinely curious if just the displaying of an ID in the polling place could actually be banned as well. But nevertheless, I do certainly credit Mr. Bremer certainly bringing up under a pretty intensive questioning, particularly a lot of skepticism on finding the right limiting principle. It was really Justice Alito stepping in and I think doing the best job of going through the absurdities. And when oral argument shifted over, and I regretfully, I'm not unsure if it, I believe Daniel Rogan of the Hennepin County Attorney's Office was, he's counsel of record for the respondents. I'm not entirely sure if he was arguing on their behalf, but the respondents really took a pretty heavy shellacking themselves, and they've backed off a bit. I think that's important to note that throughout this case, and certainly the opinions I've read, that the breadth of this was very apparent, and the idea that, well, yeah, if it has any kind of political attire, if it's NRA or the like, then it can be banned. Now we have apparently some kind of limiting principle, perhaps in the instructions that are being given out to Minnesota poll workers. But the idea that it must be understood as relating to an election and that it must be well known. Justice Alito really shot that down, saying that actually makes it worse. One point that was interesting to kind of show that when you start getting into different ideas of what's well known is that Justice Alito brought up, would it be okay to wear a rainbow flag? And respondents said that, well, that would be permissible as long as gay rights wasn't an issue on the ballot. Notably, this was minutes went by, and later on, Justice Breyer, perhaps just in a slip, but in sort of a telling slip, started talking about, well, we've heard about the Rainbow Coalition. And of course, the Rainbow Coalition is long defunct and really didn't actually have anything to do with gay rights. That was more about minority rights. So you can see the confusion itself was certainly on display a little bit in the argument as well. Particularly what probably put the respondents in a corner is when you start having and I would urge everyone to listen to the oral argument once it becomes available, because I think it was certainly worthwhile. But I also might have to re-listen to it myself, because there's a lot of back and forth, and sometimes it got a little bit confusing. But the point is that at one point, for example, the NRA, which is probably well known and established and has plays in pretty much every election, well, that's going to be banned. But what if somebody showed up with something like Parkland Strong button saying that, which of course would reference the recent mass shooting in Florida, and therefore might reference support for gun control measures. So where that kind of starts heading down the path, and they didn't get too far into this into detail here, but I think that sort of inevitably leads that even if you're going to go into a forum analysis here, the idea that, well, this is a non-public forum, and therefore, as long as there's no viewpoint discrimination, we can pretty much censor anything, you know, under current doctrine. I think that kind of gives the lie to that, because the idea, well, overbroad laws, even in the sense of non-public forums, can go ahead and create a de facto viewpoint discrimination. I think that distinction between the National Rifle Association and a hypothetical like Parkland Strong really shows it's almost all but inevitable. I think, you know, certainly my other big impression, and maybe this could have been hammered a little harder, and I think to her credit, it was Justice Kagan who I think had a little lighthearted criticism of this idea as the polling place as sacred ground, and that term wasn't necessarily used, but there's almost, and I've run into this in some of my own litigation, a sort of strange reverence given to the polling place. And that's great. I'm glad we as Americans, we should jealously guard our right to vote, and we should certainly have orderly polling places. But at the same time, don't treat it like people walk in there and have this, and this certainly was used, this idea that now we can suspend all politics and that voters will take that time, that moment, and they will pause and reflect before pulling that lever or filling in that bubble or hitting the button on the electronic voting machine. I certainly have not worked the polls in my life as a poll worker, but I have voted many times, and the polling place, I'm curious what polling place they're talking about, because I have certainly never been to one. It's usually a gymnasium, and people are bustling in and out and just want to get their vote done and get out of there. So, again, with all due respect, I think there are ample ways, and already ample ways in existence, that the polling place can certainly be regulated without quite elevating it to a monastery. So, but that came up, and I think that was Justice, again, credit to Justice Kagan for kind of lampooning that at least a little bit. I think the thing that I would say in closing is there was certainly on the part of the respondents a fairly chilling conclusion. And Justice Kagan, I think, jokingly said, you know, after pinging the respondents a little bit on a point, said, you know, she jokingly said, maybe you should make the law broader. And to which, you know, almost hook, line, and sinker, the respondents actually replied, yeah, we could make it broader. And that kind of goes back to my other point. I mean, where does this end? So overall, difficult, and I think there is a lot of reticence to necessarily revisit Burson. Again, even though we're inside a polling place now, we're not dealing with buffer zone. That was floating over this. There's an effort here to find the limiting principle, and I'm frankly outside of Justice Alito, and I know it's never a good idea to make bets following oral argument, but I would be certainly thinking outside of Justice Alito. I had no real clear impressions where anyone was standing, and I certainly think that this is going to be a potentially, and it's worth pointing out that Burson v. Freeman was a plurality opinion. There were a lot of different concurrences there and a dissent. So I think that's, you know, that's certainly possible as well, that there's going to be a lot of differing perspectives onto just how much reverence we're going to give the polling place and what reasoning is going to, what which First Amendment doctrine is most important to apply to the law in question. So I think certainly at this time, Dean, I think I'm ready to turn it over to questions.
Very good. Thank you for that summary. We've got no questions pending, so our lines are wide open. Push the star button, then the pound button on your phone. I'll start by asking a question. How much of the discussion really went to the different and how many of the questions went to the different hypotheticals? And I can imagine a few of my own. You know, can you wear a Federalist Society tie? Well, we're a 501c3, but some folks identify the Federalist Society as aligned with certain positions, even though we don't take positions. Could you, on the other hand, I mean, is somebody free to wear a sandwich board, one of the old sort of fashioned boards you put over top of you? With the, and then the specific idea in that case is to usually typically get somebody to buy something. And then you can get some very, very nuanced sort of examples. I can imagine Michael Jordan running for city council in Chicago, and can somebody then wear Michael Jordan shoes with the idea of endorsing him and trying to get others to vote for him? It does seem a bit like a quagmire once you start going down that path.
Yeah, agreed. And there were several lines, particularly from Justice Alito, but from other justices as well, where it became sort of a machine gun style name something. And I've got written down here in very characteristic handwriting, but asked if would a Colin Kaepernick jersey be okay? And I think the respondents replied, well, that would be allowed. Well, what about All Lives Matter? That could be interpreted as political material. And then, you know, sort of again falling into this, well, these are really tough calls, and poll workers need to be able to make those calls. And again, in the name of orderliness, and again, it all goes down to this: well, is it understood to be political material, and we are dealing with a well-known issue? And that's again, I would certainly echo Justice Alito's sentiments that that really only makes it worse in the context. So there were several different lines of questioning that really focused. The one time the respondents had a complete disavowal of something that wouldn't be enforced was the idea that if everybody decided to get together, a big group of voters who vote at the same polling place got together and for one reason or another decided to make a statement by all wearing white, and then they'd all show up and overwhelmingly be wearing white. The respondent said, well, that wouldn't count because that's not a badge, button, or insignia.
Interesting. But if word were gotten out the day before that everybody who wants to vote for or against a certain proposition ought to wear white, that would pass muster.
Well, again, I think that, again, the only unequivocal time they said that's the only unequivocal time they said that would pass muster and probably couldn't be interpreted under the law as being covered as a regulable.
Interesting. You've mentioned, and we have one question pending. We'll get to that just momentarily. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. You've mentioned a couple times in passing volunteers, the poll watchers, the poll volunteers. Does this statute apply to them? Are there more stringent requirements or prohibitions on what they can wear or can't wear?
The statute definitely does apply to them. This applies to any person. I don't know of anything in addition to the requirements put on them. But it's important to note, you know, generally speaking, in a variety of states, and probably Minnesota included, that and they went into some detail and some discussion about how poll workers are selected, particularly election. I think election judges are probably distinct from poll workers, and they sort of have the authority to decide what these things are, and they're picked from the two major parties, and that's supposed to sort of alleviate any, you know, concerns about viewpoint discrimination. I certainly was not convinced about that. And it's interesting to point out, and this came up at the end of, near the end of oral arguments, that, and this is also detailed in the Eighth Circuit's opinion below, was the idea that, well, the punishment here is a potential $300 fine. The respondent said it's the equivalent of a speeding ticket. And the point is that you will not actually be prevented from voting if you show up and you have what's considered political attire, and you're told, well, you can cover it up, and then you say, this isn't political attire, and then you will still be allowed to vote, but your name will be taken down and you might be charged later. There's probably a really good Minnesota joke in there, but I think Justice Roberts did a great job by saying, well, that really eliminates the interest you're trying to put forth here. If this is really about risks intimidation in a polling place, then you're not really serving that interest. If this is about distractions in a polling place, you're not really serving that interest. If this is about just general orderliness, you're not really serving that interest if you're just allowing this to happen and with some threat that we might prosecute you later. It's really the idea that the statute really does operate on the chill, the First Amendment chill, or the fear will keep them in line.
What, again, if could you say a few more words about the announced goal here? Is it to prevent influence? Is it to prevent coercion or intimidation?
On this part, Dean, I'm particularly cynical that there is I think there's great intent here, and there's a legitimate concerns about disruptions in polling places. And one of the problems with the Burson case was that came from, and I believe it was Tennessee, but one of the more southern states that had certainly had a lot of problems in Reconstruction and with other civil rights issues. And one of their laws, the laws at issue at Burson, it wasn't actually at issue, but one of the laws that actually prohibited police presence in polling places. So that seemed, to me to be a big deal as far as, well, now we need to have all these other prophylactic measures. But that's not the case, as far as I know, in Minnesota. It's certainly not the case in a lot of other states. I'm litigating a polling place-related speech case in Michigan right now. And that's fascinating, that when there is serious disruption, you can actually call the police without issue. You can even have them there in advance if you sense something bad is going to go down. And that was, I think, a really big distinction in the Burson case than we're dealing with in a lot of other states.
Interesting. Well, we do have one audience question pending. We'll go to that audience member momentarily. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's check in with our audience at this time. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, this is Mark up in New York. I thought the presentation is excellent, so thank you for filling us in on this. My question, which you've already touched on a little bit, is really the remedy. How does it really work in the real world when someone goes into one of these polling places with a shirt that maybe violates the law, maybe doesn't, maybe is political, maybe is not political? Like, how do these really get resolved? Like, who makes the initial decision? Like, there may be a problem here. Who follows up? Who debates? Kind of, what is the process here? I ask this from the perspective of, like, jury instructions. Like, you have these grandiose jury instructions in a trial, but at the end of the day, you need to give them to jurors to actually follow it. And that's my question here is, how do poll watchers and people in these positions really follow this law in the real world?
Thanks for the question. I think, and they went into some detail, and the idea is that people will be, again, that judgment call, first of all, and that's really the crux of the case, is who gets the judgment call. And it seems that even with instructions that bolster the law at issue, it's still very broad. And I should go back to, when we're dealing with First Amendment principles, The concept of First Amendment overbreath is different from overbreath. It's more stringent than it is in other contexts, where instead of saying it has to be unconstitutional in all of its applications, it really needs to be only unconstitutional in a significant number of applications, as when compared to its plainly legitimate sweep. And so The danger, though, that overbreadth is protecting against is very similar to vagueness, is that's arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement. So the crux of it is right there at that first judgment call, that when you have such a broad law, that broad authority is already, when you're dealing with the regulation of speech, is already a danger, and a very real one at that. So that's where it begins. And the idea is that then the poll worker will, and I think, again, I give credit to Mr. Bremer arguing for the Voters Alliance for hitting this, I believe more than once, by saying, well, here's where the disruption actually happens. It's like somebody walking in with an NRA T-shirt is not actually disrupting or distracting anybody in a polling place. Where that becomes a disruption or distraction or a delay is when the poll worker steps up and says, you can't wear that. And then it turns into not necessarily an ordeal, but maybe a discussion. And that discussion's going to take the attention away from other duties. And then there's going to be a discussion amongst the poll workers who are deciding, you know, amongst themselves, again, because this is such an arbitrary law, well, does this fit the definition of political badge, button, or insignia? And then the idea is that whoever gets the final say. Then, of course, the Justice Breyer tried to make this point, and I wasn't entirely sure what he was going for here, but then the citizen has to make that choice of their own determination of whether this is political attire and proceed accordingly. What then happens is that their name is written down in a book, and they might be prosecuted later on. Again, it's to the credit of Minnesota. They're not like the state of certain other states that would deprive people of their right to vote in that instance. But again, I think that really certainly diminishes the interests that are trying to be served. And I forget which justice pointed this out, but the fact is that in order to be, you know, intercepted, you know, you have to come into the polling place. It's the poll workers with this authority. They're already working inside the polling place. So, you know, the violation has already occurred by the time you're asked to cover up. So a lot of those technical details did come up, and that seemed to be toward the latter end of the argument, that they were really just trying to clarify, well, what is it that's actually going on here. But I would say, again, the crux of the argument here is just having that authority in the first place, this broad of an authority.
So when you give them your name, do you then have to show them your ID?
Oh, there's no voter ID requirement in that's a really good question.
All right, so if I say, hey, I need your name now so I can give you a ticket, and then I give you my name, do I now need to show you my ID in violation of the voter ID law? Or can I just give my neighbor's name?
Eric
Holder's
name.
That
did not come up, but that's a very good point.
Very good. If you'd like to join the queue for questions, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending, then our lines will be wide open. Looks like we've got a second question, so let's carry on. Go ahead, caller.
Yes, hello. This is Arthur Hellman. I missed the first part of it, so maybe you've answered this. I don't know if you saw an op-ed or maybe it was just a blog post by Richard Hazen, who runs the election law blog, defending the law and laws like it, saying that in this age of, you know, polarized voters, that this is a way of avoiding conflict because you have one group coming with one set of signs and badges and another with another, and each of them testing the limits of the law, and the law is justified, I think he was saying, as a way of just avoiding getting into that. Did that come up at all with the argument, and how would you respond to it?
Professor Hassan, in my experience, has never met a governmental interest he didn't like more than free speech. So that's what I will, my general assessment. As far as the polling places go, it's interesting because these cataclysmic possible circumstances don't occur, and that came up in the regards to other states that only prohibit, as what was upheld in Burson, actual electioneering. So whether it's 9 or 11 states, it's a minority of states that have broader than an electioneering ban, and are in fact, you know, so those are the states where you can go vote wearing an NRA apparel or Black Lives Matter or things that do not relate to the election or defeat of a candidate. And we haven't seen that kind of activity. And that it's really up, it would be, and I think Justice Gorsuch pointed this out quite well. Well, it's the government's job, the state, that needs to put forth this interest, the interest that justifies the ban. And that really puts them in a tough corner when this, across the country, in a majority of states, we haven't seen that kind of the hypothetical of that Professor Hassan mentions. And I want to point out as well that this has come up in a lot of these polling places, and I believe the respondents leaned on this heavily, and kind of they want to use Burson because that was also, again, it was mid-1990s, but it really relied on all of the election reforms that really swept across the country in the late 1890s. And that involved, a lot of those are, by all means, I would never want to reverse them, including the Australian, that is the secret ballot, was actually a major change that I think was absolutely for the best. But with that, prohibitions against intimidation and actual other, certain other crimes. Before that, for a republic that lasted, again, it's worth noting the American experiment did endure, go through 100 years, and it wasn't all bad before that. But there was, there are plenty of stories from before those reforms about showing up to the polling place with kegs, about parties making their own ballots, basically, and they were all of a, even though there'd be a secret voting, maybe your ballot would be the right color so that people knew, you were only voting for their candidates in advance. So leaning on, my position is that governmental interests can change. It's free speech, however, among our other natural rights, those endure. And sometimes you have to step back and you have to reassess in light of changed circumstances. So the idea that, Professor Hassan and many other reformers can continue to dream of the 1890s, maybe they should move to Portland, but that's not necessarily the case anymore. And this is worth pointing out, and my plug here is that what's interested me so much in this case is that and I've done a previous teleforum on this issue, is the area of what's called the ballot selfies, or the idea of ballot photographs. And these are predominantly young voters. They go to the polls, and like people wearing, some poor Minnesotan wearing a Tea Party shirt, they have no reason to think that it's illegal for them to take a picture of their marked ballot after they voted for someone. They're very excited about that. And then they go and they post that to social media. And that supposedly is a violation of ballot exposure laws, which in Michigan, in the case where I'm litigating, would actually require you to forfeit your ballot, assuming you got caught actually taking a picture of it. Otherwise, and this is a point of contention between me and opposing counsel, that might also get you incited for a misdemeanor for unauthorized photography in a polling place, even though you weren't photographing somebody else or somebody else's ballot for that matter, but just your own ballot inside of a voting station. So then they lean on this idea that there's going to be all this rampant fraud. And yet, again, there are plenty of other states. We won the case in Colorado against ballot photography restrictions, and there has yet to be any credible case about somebody, selling their vote by being able to take a picture of their ballot or things of that nature. And I think that burden shifting is very important. It's not so much shifting, but just recognizing that in these First Amendment cases, we need to put the onus on the government to establish whatever it interests, whether it's a compelling governmental interest, an important governmental interest, even at a rational basis. I would like the court to start taking a little more scrutiny, and just that was a very telling point by the respondents to say, well, it's the same as Burson. We're relying on this history. Well, it's been 120 years. Can we, maybe get some fresh review of whether these are justified laws?
Well, it's a somewhat related issue. The Florida judge's solicitation for money, where Chief Justice Roberts uncharacteristically was very credulous toward the assertions of governmental interest. I think it was Justice Alito wrote the dissent and just shredded the assertions that this was necessary to prevent corruption, given all the holes in the law and the exceptions and the limitations of the law. But Chief Justice Roberts accepted it and said, yeah, they've made their case. So you're right that it does depend on the burden, and yet judges vary greatly, as of course you know, in their willingness to accept the supposed evidence or the arguments that states put forth.
I think that's a very good point, and I think that goes back here. I was having a conversation with someone at the court just after arguments, and they brought up the same point, and that's another reason why this is such a fascinating, I always march into these things pretty gung-ho as a First Amendment litigator myself, and this is open and shut, and well, precisely because of cases like Williams-Uly, which you just mentioned, where these certain institutions find themselves drawing more fidelity than constitutional principles in certain instances. And as you mentioned about Chief Justice Roberts, I don't want to be flippant about dismissing the importance of voting, the importance of orderly polling places, but this idea that we're putting constitutional rights on some kind of we have to have some kind of balancing test here, when I think it's very quite more than possible, in fact quite easy, to respect both in this instance.
Thank you.
We've got one question pending, then our lines are wide open. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's head in a new direction here.
This is Todd Gazziano from the Pacific Legal Foundation. I'm David Bremer's colleague who brought and argued this case. So I wanted to thank you, Stephen, for your fine coverage. And I was in the courtroom with you, and I wanted to ask you about one of two things that I thought were pivotal moments and your impression thereof, but I missed the first 3 minutes of your call, so I apologize if you've already gone over it. But when Justice Alito was asking the respondent's attorney about what would and would not be prohibited, you discussed some of the examples, I know. But when he got to the text of the Second Amendment, the attorney for respondent said he thought that would be banned. Then he was asked about the text of the First Amendment, and he paused. But he thought, well, the First Amendment wasn't necessarily so political. My prediction is that's going to be written up in about every other news story on the case. Do you think that persuaded many of the justices, or will do so, that the application is too broad?
Thanks for the question, Mr. Gazziano. I think you do raise a very good point, and that was definitely what I hope will be a pivotal moment. And it was a good, it'd be funny if it wasn't so sad to have that in that moment. And I juxtaposed earlier, I think, NRA versus the hypothetical Parkland Strong button, I think puts kind of the same issue into perspective. Well, guns are a political issue, but man, First Amendment, no, that's not a political issue. So, I hope so. I think my concern goes back to where, the frustration that was expressed, particularly by Justice Kennedy, throughout about give me the limiting principle. I want it right now. And that was probably the part that you could say was missing. But again, that is, I think, a point that Mr. Bremer made very well, that's not, when you're dealing with facial overbreath, striking down a law is not the end of, it can very well be the end of the story. And that might be actually a very good piece of judicial restraint, is to say, you got this wrong, and the Minnesota legislature is welcome to go back and try it again. And that should be, if they get it wrong, well, we might come back here. But that was another great moment in the areas of the hypotheticals.
Let me make another final call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on our telephone, on your telephone, rather. The lines are wide open. We do have another question, so let's check in with yet another caller.
Hi, this is Michael Rossman with the Center for Individual Rights. I have two quick questions, and again, like several past callers, I think I missed the first 3 or 4 minutes of the discussion, so if I am asking a question you've already answered, I apologize. First, was there any discussion of Marx versus the United States, and how to interpret a rationale from the splintered decisions in Burson, or were the justices simply using Burson as a starting point and saying, well, we'll just figure out for ourselves exactly what lines to draw? And second, was any mention made of the fact that people don't always vote at voting places these days? They vote at, you know, before elections, they vote at home, and whether or not the rationale of the respondents could be applied outside of just the voting booth on election day.
As to the first question, there was no discussion of Burson's plurality status or how to interpret it. It was really just taken as a given, which is a little bit surprising. As to the second question, no, that also really wasn't discussed in much detail. And I would point back to at least, you know, sometimes this case, you know, the arguments, you know, are going to wander a little bit far off. But this one, the sentence of the law that is at issue relates to the wearing of things on or about the polling place on primary or election day. So at least that's the non-overbroad or vague part of the statute, that those are the days it applies. So as to going to absentee places where you might be voting absentee or those, it doesn't really seem to trigger the law at issue here. So,
thank you.
Well, Stephen Klein, I think we've had our final question. Let me give you, we still got some time left, give you a minute or two to wrap up or express a final thought.
I would simply revisit that. I think the most important thing here is to certainly keep in mind, and I do reemphasize, I think voting is very important, but there has to be limits on the kind of power given to election regulators in how they go about running a polling place. When you have people, you know, citizens, and we're trying to always trying to increase voter turnout and increase participation and have citizens involved in our democracy, it's very important not to punish them for participating in it. And I think a lot of this could have been avoided with just a little calmer and a little less treatment of polling places as some kind of holy site. I'm curious, and I still remain I think it's unpredictable how this case is going to turn out, and I think I'm certainly wary of the fallout if it falls along the lines of possibly expanding Burson. We've seen, you know, that this proves again, you know, the sort of the adage, if you give a, you know, you give the government, you know, just an inch or a 100-foot a buffer zone, man, they're gonna really try and take as much out of that as they can. So, again, I do recommend, once the audio is available, I think this was a very worthwhile oral argument, worth listening to, and the briefing, and again, certainly on the constitutional litigation side, again, a lot of kudos to the Pacific Legal Foundation and all the attorneys who worked on this case for going on 8 years, and hopefully, even if it's going to be a 5-4, it comes down on the right side.
Well, my thanks to Stephen Klein at the Pillar of Law Institute. We certainly appreciate your time today, especially going to the court and giving us your download on what transpired there. I want to thank the audience as well for dialing in and for your questions. A reminder about our next scheduled teleform conference call tomorrow. It's the Lucia case versus SEC. That's tomorrow at noon Eastern time. That's the case that involves an agency administrative law judge, separation of powers, the appointments clause being argued tomorrow. And we will cover it as we did this case with the Courthouse Steps teleform. But until that next teleform, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.